Sharon thought the three fenning fine a sign of the tyranny of feudalism, and said so in greater irritation than the size of the fine warranted, or indeed than Ackerman had probably expressed in paying it. Tom thought of correcting her equation of feudalism with manorialism, but said only, "Try buying your liquor across the bridge in New Jersey. You'll learn what fine the lords of Pennsylvania levy for breaking their monopoly if they catch you at it." But the lukewarm reception of his glad tidings was something of a damper, and Tom felt as if he had been dumped unceremoniously into a cold stream. The other thing about Judy's calls that sometimes irritated Sharon was their odd timing. They were as apt to come at one hour of the day as any other. Did that girl never sleep? And of course Tom would leap to answer the ring. It didn't matter much what he was doing. Clearing the dinner dishes, they could wait. Driving the car, that's why God invented cell phones. Sharon was the sort who regarded any great display of eagerness as unseemly. Laid back, or cool, they used to say, and meant it as compliment. Tom's grin began to annoy her. A little gravitas would not hurt. One evening, while Tom was deep into a travel book on the customs and legends of the Black Forest, one never knew where unexpected goal might lie on Earth, Sharon appeared in front of his recliner, wagging his cell phone at him. "It's your new girlfriend," she said. "Again." Tom closed the book on his finger. Sometimes he wasn't sure how to take Sharon. He would admit this now and then after a few beers, and if Sharon were not around. They kidded each other a lot, but at times he thought her comments had an edge to them, a thin and delicate edge, because he didn't always feel the slice right off. "She's not my girlfriend," he said. He and Sharon had been together longer than most married couples, and so certain customs had grown up between them, much as moss will accumulate on a damp rock, or ivy creep up the walls of hallowed halls. They had long ago agreed that possessiveness had no place in their relationship, and so regarded any show of it with a sort of horror. But that was theory. Practice was something else. For too little possessiveness may also have its hazards. Moss may be a soft and comfortable thing upon which to rest, but it is also the very same sort of thing, and its flowers require a certain subtleness of thought to admire. Now and then Tom wished that Sharon would loosen up, and Sharon that Tom would grow more steady. Sharon, who had not meant the comment all that seriously, jiggled the phone a little in her hand as she appraised his reaction. "Turn that thing to vibrate," she told him, handing it over. "And keep it with you. That's the whole point of a portable phone." Without another word, she crossed to her sofa, where she curled up like the hidden dimensions of the polyverse. She found it difficult to concentrate at first on Janet Poor's space, which she attributed to the residuum of the interruption. Tom acknowledged the command with an absent wave. "Did you hear that, Judy?" he asked the grainy image on the cell phone screen. "Sharon thinks you're my new lover." Judy frowned and said, "Maybe I should not call you at home." Sometimes the stuffy propriety of the younger generation was a little hard to take. "Oh, Sharon doesn't mind you calling." He dropped his voice when he said this so that he would not disturb the physicist on the sofa. "Everything's fine. What do you have for me?" In truth, he looked forward to these exchanges. Judy scratched his curiosity where it itched. "She and I click," he had told Sharon already. "She knows historical research, which databases to tap, which archivists to contact. She knows what I'm looking for, so I don't have to explain things twice." And Sharon had answered, "She's a treasure, all right." "I think I know why the village's name was changed," Judy announced. "Das geht ja Weisskatzenmarken," Tom exclaimed, which did disturb the physicist on the sofa and earned him a glare which he did not notice. "Meine kleine Durchblickerin, sieg mir deisen Nachricht." Judy had gotten used to that sort of thing by then. She had no idea what he had said, but did have a good idea what he wanted, so a translation was not needed. She did something off the screen, and the image of a manuscript replaced her face. It is not possible to hop out of a recliner, but Tom managed it anyway. He hurried to Cleodanus, where he inserted his phone into the docking station, and the manuscript appeared at a more readable magnification on the monitor. The handwriting was 14th-century work. The Latin was awful. Cicero would have wept. "I used the Soundex to look for variant spellings," Judy explained while he skimmed the document. "That casts a wider loop, of course, and it takes longer to sort through the crimpa, the junk. What am I looking at?" "It's a bull from 1377 against the Brethren of the Free Spirit. It seems that Oberhochwald's new name was not originally Eiffelheim at all, but Teufelheim." Tom had skimmed ahead, and his finger now touched the screen lightly where the name appeared. "Devilholm." He chewed on his thumb knuckle while he considered that. What sort of people had lived there, he wondered, to have earned such a name from their neighbors? "Shun the works of Satan," he read aloud, "as we shun the unholy soil of Teufelheim. Pastor Dietrich was tried and found wanting. Be you not also found wanting, sick with heresy and sorcery, etc., etc." Tom sat back in his chair. "Well, the writer doesn't care much for our friend Dietrich. I wonder what he did that was so terrible, besides stiffing that coppersmith." He saved the file to his drive, and Judy's face reappeared on the screen. "The connection seemed clear to me," she said.
"Yes, well, I mentioned Dietrich in the next sentence, unless Teufelheim was Oberhochwald.
Although," he rubbed his ear with his finger, "in all of Swabia, I suppose there could be two Dietrichs. Dr. Wenger, in the language department, said that the corruption of Teufelheim to Eiffelheim was linguistically natural."
"Ja, wenn man Teufel spricht, kommt her."
Tom called up the area map on a split screen and double-clicked on the village's icon so he could add the latest gloss on the name. This version of the map showed the actual geography with landforms in shadowed relief. The village sat on a spur of the Feldberg by a steep ravine leading into the Hollenthal. And what better route might there be to Devil's Home than through Hell Valley? At the lower end of Hell Valley sat none other than Himmelreich, Kingdom of Heaven. It was a topsy-turvy sort of nomenclature, with the devil on the mountaintop and heaven down below. Tom saved the new information, but with a mild feeling of anticlimax, or perhaps of a slight hangover.
"We still don't know why the place was abandoned, but I guess we're one step closer."
"But we do know," Judy told him. "Demons. Devil home."
Tom was not convinced. "No," he said. "It's one more place name in the Schwarzwald named after the devil, like Teufelsmühle near Stauffenberg, or the Devil's Pulpit. There are two Devil's Pulpits, one by Baden-Baden and the other on the Kneipes. Plus Hex Valley and Hell Valley and..."
"But did you read the descriptions of the devils that this Dietrich supposedly conjured?"
He hadn't, but he recalled the file and this time read past the comment on the name. "Ugly sons of bitches, weren't they?" he said when he found the passage. "Yellow, bulging eyes, gibbering incantations, driving men mad. They danced naked but sported no manhood."
The color control on the monitor, he noted, was fine enough to show Judy's blush.
"I don't suppose demons ever won beauty contests."
"They flew, too. This must be what started those folk tales about the Krenkel."
"A few sentences in a bull? No."
The writer was repeating a story already in circulation. He expected his readers to understand the reference, just as he expected them to know who Pastor Dietrich was.
"I wonder if Krenkel comes from Krunklein. South German shortens line to L."
"I thought..."
"What?"
"Well, the descriptions of the demons were so detailed, so vivid. Their appearance... Even the way the villagers behaved. Some saved themselves and their souls. Others befriended the demons and welcomed them unto their very hearts."
Tom dismissed her suggestion even before she could nerve herself to make it. "All it takes is a little imagination and a bit of hysteria. The medievals were great believers in mythic beasts. They heard vague tales of the rhinoceros and imagined a unicorn out of it. The horsemen of the steppes became centaurs. They had kobolds and dwarves, and I saw a drawing in a Psalter in the Walters Gallery in Baltimore that showed two weird creatures, one like a stag, the other like a big cat, walking on their hind legs and carrying a pall-draped bier between them. And there's a fresco in the crypt of the Freiburg Franziskanerkirche that shows giant grasshoppers sitting at a banquet table, probably a metaphor for the way locusts could consume entire harvests. And a carved doorpost in the cloisters in New York portrays,
"All right,